Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Meg Lohman, PhD, also known as Canopy Meg, biologist, educator, ecologist, writer, editor, and public speaker. And we're talking about her new book, The Arbonaut, A Life Discovering the Eighth Continent in the Trees Above Us. Canopy Meg, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Oh, what a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
This is a memoir, and this book travels all around the world, but I love the chapters of when you were a child. Talk to me about how your childhood prepared you for a life in science.
That's amazing for you to say that, because I wrote those childhood chapters with great hesitation. I was such a geek. I was a non-event. I was so ordinary in many ways that I just thought, if only maybe those chapters would touch those other ordinary kids
right.
of the world, perhaps I could be a role model for them. So that's really the spirit of those chapters. But gosh, I was the only kid in my school that went bird watching, and I had those wildflower collections, and all my friends made fun of me. So at the end of the day, I'm quite embarrassed about being a child, but I realized too it formulated me in a quiet way, and it forced me into nature because trees did not talk back. And really shy, and I guess they were my friends, so that was a comfort as a kid.
I really identified with those chapters. I just want to say that now, because I was that kind of a kid too.
Oh, that's great.
And now I have a life in natural history, so that's cool.
Right. And you overcame a lot of hurdles, you and I, so
yep.
Good for you.
Well, great for you. Now, I want to talk about one of the themes before we get into your work, also that's very important in this book, is sexism. And it's not didactic in this book, but time and again, as a pioneering woman biologist, you just seem to run into walls left, right, and center. That didn't stop you. Thank God. But talk to me about that. I mean, at the time that you were becoming a biologist, God, the hurdles that women scientists have to overcome just seemed insurmountable.
It is hard to believe, and I guess it dates me in a sense that I've been at this gig called science for about 50 years. So at the end of the day, I will say, first and foremost, I'm the mother of two wonderful boys, and I love inspiring boys in science, and I've been surrounded by men on every expedition, so I really don't mind any kind of gender imbalance, but I do mind women not being at the decision-making table. And so often I was asked to make the coffee or organize the food for an expedition. I think it's time for women to speak up. I was pretty shy. I didn't tell most of those stories throughout my whole career, except quietly to some of the girls that came crying into my office about certain issues. So I think at the end of the day, as a senior woman scientist, I needed to, you know, be clear that women have to support each other and that, yes, there are hurdles. And even today, there are still hurdles. It's not over. And I do hope that will help other readers of the book, both male and female, to be more gentle and kind to each other.
When did you start getting interested in the upper canopy of forests? I mean, that's like getting interested in the bottom of the ocean. I mean, it's a good analogy because nobody got up there.
You know, I never even heard of a rainforest except reading National Geographic as a kid. I never learned about it in elementary school or high school. And golly, I got this amazing scholarship to Sydney University for my PhD. And all of a sudden, I confronted these enormously tall trees where I certainly couldn't see the top. And it did all along throughout my whole childhood and college days, you know, gave me a fascination, but it was never so severe as when I first saw my first tropical rainforest. And because I was a leaf lover, I knew that I had to figure out how to get into the leaves. I couldn't simply shoot them down with a slingshot or wait for them to fall every year and hope to learn all their secrets. So, and my advisor encouraged me, mind you, he never climbed a tree, but he just said, I think you can figure something out.
No, you go, Meg, you go.
They all watched, but I was so hoping that I could train a monkey. Wouldn't that have been cool?
And, that would have been cool.
Anyway, not a chance. There are no native monkeys in Australia, of course. So lo and behold, I did sew my first harness and weld this crazy slingshot and do a whole bunch of things that, lo and behold, another guy named Don Perry was doing in Costa Rica, but we never knew each other without internet. And so a little bit of that was going on around the world, but I certainly had to tiptoe and make my own way into this field of becoming an arbornaut.
Talk to me about the tropical forests of Australia. I've been there three times and I've been in those forests. What are the trees that comprise the tropical forest?
First of all, of course, there are hundreds, even thousands
right.
of species.
Are there dominant species?
And in a couple cases, and this was part of my research along the way, we had unusual, what we call mono-dominant stands. Now, remember that most people travel from the temperate zones in academia to the tropics to ask questions about diversity. So they always pick sites with lots of species. But lo and behold, some 20% of rainforests do have a predominance of one or two species. And that's interesting in its own right. But I studied a couple of each. I studied the Antarctic beech, which tends to grow with its sisters and brothers. And I also studied things like the sassafras and the giant singing tree and the coachwood, trees that do get surrounded by different kinds of species. And for reasons of survival, those diverse stands are often much more resilient than those stands of one species.
Now, how tall?
In Australia, upwards of 200 feet. Certainly Asia and some Amazon emergent trees, we get up to 300 feet. But overall, you do have to exceed about 100 feet to get into the true sunny canopy of most rainforests.
What did people do before you when they wanted to know about what went on way up there? I mean, they knew stuff was going on, I guess. But what did they do? Did they chop down trees, right?
They sure did. And I made that analogy in my prologue that maybe if you went to the doctor and they just examined your big toe and tried to tell you everything about your health, you would really question it. I think foresters with the best interests walked through the forest, looked up, maybe gazed with binoculars, and just said, oh, this tree is healthy, or oh, maybe there's this much board feed, or maybe they thought there was an insect attack up there, but they really did not have much detail. And you are right. Only when the tree got cut down could they make some kinds of discoveries, but most things flew away or got squished, or in the case of birds, went off and nested somewhere else. So they really did have a very myopic view of what I call the whole tree. And arbornauts have unfolded all of our new knowledge about whole trees, not just the bottom of the tree.
Now, you're using the term arbornaut, which is the name of the book. But another term that you use, and I love this, the eighth continent. Talk to me about how you came up with that.
Sure. And a handful of us did. I won't take credit for it. But, you know, when we go into the canopy, especially when I was in Australia all by myself, it was extraordinary. It was full of sounds and smells and sights. And you absolutely felt like you might have been on Mars. And, of course, that word arbornaut is related to astronauts who explore outer space. Arbornauts explore the treetops. But I truly felt that I could have been like, you know, some kind of explorer. Maybe I was Shackleton or doing something wonderful in Africa, but I was in this whole new world where we now know less than 10% of species are classified. So in that sense, it kind of becomes a new continent that, like Columbus, we said, wow, look at this. We must explore it.
Now, how did you figure out the rigging of how to get to the canopy top? And one of the things you did is you studied with spelunkers, with cavers.
That's right. I'm so grateful that I got adopted by the Sydney University Caving Club. And they went down, and I wanted to go up. They laughed and thought that was hilarious, but they were kind and gentle and lent me some of their ropes and equipment to trial my new ideas. So that was fantastic. And without them, I probably wouldn't have had the opportunity. Do you know, in 1979, when I started, people didn't have recreational catalogs for buying climbing.
Oh, yeah.
Going online and looking at a YouTube video. So I really, really was flailing on that rope, literally and figuratively.
You must have felt terrified going up a tree that high.
I actually did, to be honest.
I mean, I tried to imagine what it was like, and you're there. And not only that, you're a solitary researcher in this regard, right? At that
so
point.
Many days. Yes, I did have to. And people say, weren't you scared? And I always say, I'm more scared crossing Fifth Avenue sometimes than I am being alone in a jungle. But that's a whole nother story.
Well, now you are. Now you're used to it. But that those first couple of voyages up must have been absolutely scary.
They were. But I was young and I was, I guess, a disruptor in my own quiet way. So determined to figure out what was up there. And I was especially intrigued by this whole leaf business.
The leaf business. And, you know, the great thing about what you write in this book is there are so many obvious questions that most people don't even consider or think about. Like in tropical forests, the leaves don't fall in the fall. They stay green throughout the year. And one of the things you started asking is, when and why do tropical forest trees' leaves fall? And then are there differences in the leaves between the lower story and the canopy? And what did you find out?
Well, of course, you have 3 hours or 3 minutes.
Okay, we'll do the...
What?
You have to buy the book for the full version, but just give me the short version.
In summary, first of all, those leaves lived a long time. My sassafras leaves lived over 20 years in the understory.
Wow.
Singing tree leaves fell after 6 months because insects just absolutely devoured them, and they were very dry and up in the windy zones of the forest. So there was so much diversity, first of all, between species, but then there was even more diversity up through the canopy. The lower level leaves are much bigger, sometimes 10 times bigger than the leaves in the sunny part of the canopy. They're darker, their photosynthesis activities are different, their insect attacks are different, and of course in the canopy you have that hot spot for energy production. So those leaves are growing faster and quicker and turning over to keep the whole machinery of energy production for the tree alive and vibrant.
It sounds so dynamic and so changing every day.
And it is. I called it the salad bar in the sky. Just because when I go to a salad bar, I see people picking out spinach or arugula. They all have their own favorites. And similarly, all the insects had their favorites. So I just was so fascinated by this giant salad bar with all these incredible millions of insects picking their favorite salads.
Well, this is the other thing. I mean, you start by studying leaves, but then the whole ecology of the canopy becomes fascinating. Insects, starting with insects, I mean, were you overwhelmed by the variety of insects? I mean, there were species that you probably have never been, named before.
I was gobsmacked. I used that word because I don't know what else. It was so overwhelming, I could hardly believe my eyes sometimes. And I'm talking millions of things in so many colors and so many shapes. And, I just had to chip away at it. I was very much an amateur entomologist, but if I could find the specific ones eating my leaves and my trees and contribute that to the world of entomology and donate those to the Australian Museum, then I felt really happy. And it just unfolded a whole new world, and for me later on a new cadre of students that would study all the insects in these different trees. But there's a whole lot left to do out there.
Were there insects that would never come down to the ground? They just stayed up in the canopy?
Absolutely. And a few that had a piece of their life cycle on the forest floor, such as, metamorphosing in the soil and then flying back up again. So there was every combination under the sun. But for the most part, again, very few people saw those insects because they were not on the forest floor and they definitely were not in the understory leaves.
Now, one of the things I want to mention about the book, The Arbonaut, is that you have these wonderful chapters in between the memoir, which are chapters about specific trees, usually about the area in the world that you're working in. Was it tough choosing one tree rather than another? In other words, was it tough to come up with a short list of trees? I have a feeling you have a great list of trees.
I have a huge list. And yes, that was one of the toughest parts of the book, is over those special trees. In a few cases, it was easy. The fig is a favorite, and the coachwood was my first climb. But for many of those different forests, oh gosh, it was, I guess, just like trying to decide who you were going to go to the prom with. If you were one of them, much less geekier than I was.
How has approaching the canopy evolved equipment-wise over the decades? I mean, you started out with this sort of really tough, you're ratcheting yourself up there. Has the equipment and the approach to the canopy improved so that the access is easier?
Yes, it's fabulous now. And I did highlight a couple occasions where I was so privileged to be part of designing new methods. I helped build the first canopy walkway in Australia because I wanted to take volunteers into the treetops to monitor the insects. I was part of a European committee that designed some of the construction cranes in the canopies over the years. I used a cherry picker when I was pregnant, which was, of course, my own invention at the time because there were no other pregnant arbornauts in the world. But I think the cool thing now is that we do have drones and we do have LIDAR, some amazing technologies to get into the canopy. But all those different technologies still require a climber. One person has to maybe find the insect that's outbreaking in the forest or look at the fungus that's attacking the leaves. Even though those techniques are so great for swaths of forest and assessing the whole Amazon, we still need those individual arbornauts to get up close and personal with the leaves.
Was there at one point people were using balloons to descend?
Yes. Oh my gosh, I forgot that one. My favorite.
That sounded a little bit iffy to me when I was reading about it in the book.
Well, one great thing about the Radeau des Cimes expeditions, of which I was particularly honored to be part of, and usually the only girl, I might add, is that there would be a team of about 50 scientists because they were funded in a way that required a collaboration. And so when we took that hot air balloon, yes, it's limited in some ways, but on the other hand, we had everyone at the very uppermost canopy. It's very hard to be just above the leaves. You can't do that with a rope.
Yeah.
It's hard to do that with a walkway that is supported by tree branches. So that hot air balloon with its associated different inflatable gadgets, there's a raft and also a sled that we use, are just so cool. I felt like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz sometimes.
Did you? And you actually even slept in the raft, didn't you?
I did.
Right over a nesting bone viper?
Yeah. Well, there's a few little things in there that maybe my mother doesn't want to read about.
That's particularly, even I know that's really crazy.
It is crazy. I know.
That's one big, fat, mean viper.
Well, field biologists must be a certain subspecies of humans, right?
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Meg Lohman, PhD, a.k.a. Canopy Meg. She's a biologist, educator, ecologist, writer, editor, and public speaker. And we're talking about her wonderful new book, The Arbornaut, A Life Discovering the Eighth Continent in the Trees Above Us. Meg, I want you to talk about Mission Green Project and what it does.
Sure. I'm so delighted. That's the last chapter of the book. And I will say that it was so important to end a book as a woman in science with some hope and some positive elements. It's very easy for young people, I think, to get depressed about tropical rainforests and their status right now. So Mission Green is, with great thanks, a new project that's born out of a parallel project called Mission Blue, which my friend Sylvia Earle, an oceanographer, has been operating for 10 years, where she identifies hope spots in oceans, places that are worthy of conservation. And she simply brings attention to those, and then local people get engaged. So I thought, wow, why don't we have Mission Green?
Yeah.
And we could identify hot spots, I call them, in rainforests where there's extremely high diversity. The forests are incredibly threatened and might disappear in the next decade. And we can turn this around, and we can do it easily without spending zillions of dollars. I have the good fortune of sharing this idea with E.O. Wilson, the wonderful father of biodiversity at Harvard, and he has backed me all the way and offered to be the honorary chair of Mission Green. And in his last book, Half Earth, he even outlined the 10 or so most endangered forests on Earth. So using his list, I've started a project where we're fundraising $10 million in 10 years to build canopy walkways, my favorite little treetop activity. And that walkway, in turn, generates ecotourism, which in turn will provide sustainable income for indigenous people. So it saves forests, conserves biodiversity, and provides a service for environmental justice, because it will hire local women and families to be the guides, to be the chefs, to be the lodge operators. And hopefully, when you get local support of saving the trees instead of cutting them, then you are really assured of good conservation stewardship. So that's Mission Green. We're really excited. We have a canopy walkway in Malaysia completed from a local corporation and highly successful. We have a walkway in the Amazon constructed, but we need to fundraise for marketing and education activities. We have a little prototype here in subtropical Florida just because it's a great place to trial different kinds of things. And believe it or not, Florida forests are highly endangered, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
So we're working away, chipping away at this list, and really excited to get donors, to get local partners, and hopefully within the next year, 10 years, save those forests that could otherwise disappear. Madagascar is next on our list.
Excellent.
Ethiopia, a couple places where, believe it or not, less than 5% of forests remain in those two countries.
Meg, if somebody wants to know more about Mission Green Project, what should they do?
They should go on my website, www.treefoundation.org, where Mission Green is a major product. We'll soon be launching an entire Mission Green website, but it's really easy to find it, and I would beg of you to do that. I think trees address climate change.
Yep.
They could help ameliorate the recent IPCC negative news. They are so important for our children. They provide so many services, and saving big trees is 1,000 times better than planting new trees. I love people planting trees, but we need to save big trees because that's really where species live. That's where the koalas hang out and the sloths. They can't really live on seedlings alone, so we've got to save those highest biodiversity stands of forest today and not tomorrow.
One of the things I found really interesting, and I really appreciated that you did this, is you really are also a champion for these, talking about these walkways, that they be ADA compliant where possible.
Absolutely. I'm committed, and you probably saw I had one of the first National Science Foundation grants to take mobility limited kids into the canopy and teach them to climb, which
I love that. Oh my God.
But when I first built the walkway in Florida, it was in the first, it was the first one built in the state park and the first public walkway in North America. So we knew we had to be really cognizant of ADA activities. And I worked so closely with the ADA committee in Florida. And it gave me such a sense of thinking, you know, even people in walkers, older people in Florida and women with strollers, as well as kids or adults in wheelchairs, they all have those same limitations. So we were actually serving a much bigger audience than just people who do have physical handicaps. So I'm excited because I think inclusivity in science is so important. As a girl who was not included a lot of the time, it gives me a much bigger empathy, I think, to try to make things right.
There's one of the chapters, I mean, they're all fantastic and really interesting in their own regard. But the chapter on Ethiopia, whenever I saw that photograph in your book of the remnant forest surrounding the religious buildings, the monks, that was both sort of weirded me out. I mean, that's all the forest that's left. That photograph in the book is mind-boggling, yet you studied those forests.
Absolutely, and still am, and I'm still dedicated to turning that situation around. And the advantage for me there is I have amazing local trust. And that's where one incident was being a woman was actually to my advantage. The head priest trust me, love me. They've built me a little hut to come back and live with them whenever it's possible after COVID perhaps. But, you know, they really want to save all of God's creatures, and I want to save biodiversity. So we're on the same page. And for just dollars, we can build beautiful stone walls around those churches
and
save the genetic libraries. It's not sending billions of dollars to a government and hoping it's not corrupt. It's simply helping the locals save their own species, which they so dearly love. And it's become a real success story. And
that's
I'm
amazing.
So proud of Ethiopia. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Again, it's a country that doesn't have money for conservation.
Right.
It doesn't have a lot of money for kids to become scientists. So we need to prioritize countries like that right now.
There's even a book, Beza, Who Saved the Forests of Ethiopia, that you can buy that'll help support some of that effort.
Exactly. And that book is, I don't know if you know, you can buy it in Amharic. I had it translated
when
I wrote it so that every copy a person buys in English pays for a kid to have one in his native language or her native language. So, you know, again, because I visited all the schools in Ethiopia every time I go there, and the kids had no books. The schools had zero libraries. And so it just dawned on me that we can't just save the forest. We have to educate the next generation so they can continue to save the forest.
There's a great list at the end of the book of what we can do to help conserve forests. Make sure all humans have a chance to encounter the world of trees. Take your kids out to a forest. Be mindful of how we may inadvertently contribute to tree loss. And become a citizen scientist. And that's another thing you advocate for, because you worked, you've worked with a lot of citizen scientists to help you gather data.
Absolutely. I'm so devoted to that. And I split my career a bit between museums and professorships and nonprofits. And certainly in the museum world, there's every opportunity to get citizens involved in science and data collection, and they can be fantastic. They help me find all those cool bugs in the Amazon canopy by standing patiently in the dark out on those canopy walkways. Thank you to all my citizen scientists who might be listening.
Number four is read all you can about forests and share that knowledge. And that includes this book. I think this is a good place to start. The Arbornaut would be a good place to read about forests and pass the knowledge on. And finally, become a steward of big trees. What does that mean?
Well, it simply means don't be satisfied to just go plant a seedling in a schoolyard. Go to your community and watch out for big trees. If people say, well, we're going to cut these big trees down to build a shopping mall, why don't you build a foyer? Why don't you build some arcade where they have a tree in the center of it? If you have people building on a property, why can't they just shift that house a little bit and have this gorgeous tree next to their house? I think we have to become much more vigilant about protecting these amazing ancestors that are those enormous trees that cannot be brought back in our lifetimes or our children's lifetime. They're the gold of the ecosystems, and yet we are squandering it without thinking it through.
My guest tonight has been Meg Lohman, PhD, also known better as Canopy Meg. Biologist, educator, ecologist, writer, editor, and public speaker. And we've been talking about her book, which will inspire you, The Arbornaut, A Life Discovering the Eighth Continent in the Trees Above Us. Canopy Meg, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.